This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Media Explode, episode 13.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy's told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through a sunken dream. To the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the...
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Media Explode. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hi there.
And Ron Richards.
Hello.
And this is iFanboy Media Explode, our monthly show unlocked by the patrons over at patreon.com/iFanboy, who unlocked the show, which we talk about non-comics media. We do our weekly Pick of the Week show. We talk about comics. We do our special edition shows and our Talks Blows and Books Blows. But this is our chance to talk about things that aren't related to comic books. It's nice. It's nice to take a break, a palate cleanser, which is great for all of us. We normally start the show with discussing what we've been enjoying on streaming since we last spoke, because what else is there to do? We're still in lockdown, basically. So why don't we start off? I'll start off.
All right. Ooh. Go for it.
So this past month, I've been watching a lot of Oscar films in anticipation of the Oscars that happened the past weekend. So I didn't watch a lot of shows. We paused our Schitt's Creek viewing. But what I wanted to highlight was a network show that's also available on Peacock.
For people
who don't have cable. And it's The Young Rock Show. It's the sitcom on NBC created by The Rock, Dwayne Johnson.
You're kidding
me. It sounds like exactly the kind of thing that Connor would really like. If it wasn't garbage.
One camera, 30-minute sitcom about The Rock's life, and it's delightful on many levels. First of all, The Rock is in it. The conceit of the show is kind of dumb. It's that in 2032 or something, The Rock's running for president. And so while he's on the campaign trail, he tells stories of his life. That's the conceit of the show.
So this is like Everybody Hates Chris, but...
Yes. Randall Park is the interviewer, always interviewing him. So the two of them open and close each episode. I'm going to recommend this to you guys for two reasons.
Okay.
We all love The Rock.
Sure.
The actors playing The Rock. So you see him in high school. You see him as like an 8-year-old, and you see him in college. Everyone playing The Rock is terrific and charming. The guy playing his dad's amazing.
Do they call him The Rock when he's 8? Or
no, they call him Dewey, actually.
Dewey?
Yeah, his mom calls him Dewey. But the reason why I'm bringing this up, besides the fact that it's actually really funny and charming and delightful and The Rock is great, is that... If you know anything about The Rock, his dad was a professional wrestler. And growing up, he hung out with Andre the Giant and Macho Man Randy Savage and Junkyard Dog. And all these guys are characters in the show. Huh. One of the best episodes was the day he had with Andre the Giant when he was 8. And they went around Hawaii where he was living and hung out and went to the movies and went to the beach. So in addition to it being a heartwarming story about this kid growing up, with a dad who's kind of a hustler and a mom who's really sweet and a grandmother who ran all of Hawaiian wrestling, who's kind of a badass, you also get all these characters from WWF from the 80s in the show. And there's a really great episode where they do a Royal Rumble and they walk you through how they plan it out and who's going to win what and what the move's going to be and how it's going to go. It's a fascinating look at behind the scenes of wrestling and a heartwarming show about this kid who comes up from nothing to eventually be The Rock. And it's actually shockingly really good. The dad character is terrific. The parents are terrific. The guy who plays him in college is really good and gets sort of mannerisms down. I've watched it on a lark. I was like, well, I love The Rock. I'll just check it out. And it's actually really, a really good show. So it's available if you're having, if you have cable, it's on NBC's, but if you don't have cable, it's on Peacock. And any fan of The Rock needs to check it out. You know, the pilot is okay, but it gets better as it goes, as they sort of find its footing. And honestly, the fact that they're all hanging out together, all these wrestlers from our childhood, is just fascinating to me. You know, as a kid who thought they all hated each other because they were wrestling, but it's just funny to watch them all sort of playing cards at his house. He was friends with all these guys.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
That's my pick. It's a 30-minute sitcom, one camera. Check it out. It's called Young Rock. The dumbest part of the show is the opening closing where he's running for president. But you can ignore that.
They're just softening us up. This guy's going to Ronald Reagan all over our asses.
There's actually a lot of conversation about that happening. That sure. He's talking about it. But also Rosario Dawson plays his VP running mate.
Oh.
It's got a lot of great people in it. And it's really funny. It actually is really funny. His dad is terrific.
Who's the actor who's his dad? I'm sorry.
I don't know who the actor is, but he's playing his dad who was a wrestler.
Okay.
He fought all those guys. You know, he was before. This is before WWF. When wrestling was regional. You know, there was. You know,
oh, yeah.
Vince McMahon owned the New York area, and The Rock's grandmother owned Hawaii. They all have their regions, and that's what they're still doing. Huh. It's really good. It's actually really, really good.
All right, then.
Cool. It's funny because I'm behind on The Flash because it hasn't been good. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I'm like, we're up to date and weekly on Grey's Anatomy, which hasn't been good.
Isn't it one long death scene?
Oh, God. It's just a... But most recently, I guess what's been enthralled us because we want to get it before it goes off the PBS app has been the Hemingway documentary, yep. The Ken Burns Lynn Novick documentary on Hemingway. You know, if you're familiar with the Ken Burns documentary au revoir, you know, usually there's
wait a minute. I was going to let it go.
What was that word you just said?
Over.
That's closer. Oof. You were closer there than armoire.
Armoire, you know, that he'll do like really long ones like Vietnam or baseball or whatever, but then they'll do shorter ones in between on
like a Dust Bowl was three episodes.
So Hemingway is 3 6-hour in total, 3 2-hour episodes about the writer, the, you know, what some say is the greatest American writer and all that sort of stuff. But I will say that started off really liking it, and then admittedly I still have an hour left to go with the last part, but I don't know if it's because the shorter format or because of the people that they have on it, but like I'm kind of closing it out with like, oh, I'm not loving this, because I just feel like it's very surfacey and very top level when I want to get a little more meaty, you know, like I want to.
I've watched episode one. I really liked episode one. I haven't watched the other two yet.
Episode one and like 3/4 of episode two are great, but then as he gets older, it just feels like they hit the fast forward button. I don't know. It just seems, you know, so.
Maybe they didn't have anything to say about him at that point.
There's a lot.
No, there's a lot to say. Yeah.
Do you like Hemingway, like as a writer? Do you like Hemingway books?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm not a Hemingway acolyte, but I've read all the books and, you know, and that sort of thing. But yeah.
Bonner?
For sure.
Oh. Yeah. I don't like it.
I love The Old Man at the Sea. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to reading The Sun Also Rises. I really want to read that one. I love his style. He's a fascinating American character.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Sure. Yep.
And they reveal all kinds of things just in the first episode about his life that makes so much sense, but you just didn't realize. I also love A Movable Feast. I love that book.
My favorite moment was when he married his third wife, Gellhorn. He was 41. She was 32. And the photo of him at 41, just for all you listening, we're 44 now, right? So we were older than him at that point, and he looked 15 years older than how I look now. So it's just like...
He went to war.
He went to several wars. Yeah, no, exactly. Bullfight.
I really like the first episode. I don't love Jeff Daniels as Hemingway.
I love Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels, but I don't know if his voice matches Hemingway's voice, but...
Sometimes it's like too much, that's Jeff Daniels.
No, I like it. Because a lot of it, they use Jeff Daniels not as the voice of Hemingway, but as the voice of Hemingway's writing. Right.
So it's a Ken Burns documentary, reading his books. So I don't love his voice as Hemingway's voice, but other than that, I think it's what I've seen. I've really enjoyed. I'm looking forward to more of it.
Yeah.
Josh, even if you don't like the writing, I think it's a really incredible documentary. At least what I've
seen. I watched. I think the first one. I just haven't. I'm a contributing member. I'll have access to it for a bit. I'm going to get through it. It's going to be fine. I was flipping through the streaming areas trying to find something to watch, and I saw this still frame of Ron Livingston on a show called Loudermilk. I was like, well, what's this? It's on Amazon Prime. And it was a series that was a sitcom on the network Audience. And you could check if you had Audience. You probably wouldn't know if you did, but you don't anymore.
Yep.
Starring Ron Livingston, it is produced by Peter Farrelly, one of the Farrellys, and another producer, Bobby Mort, who is a Colbert Reporter writer. It takes place in Seattle. He is an alcoholic who runs a group of a group meeting for alcoholics at a church, and he's super crabby. Like, if you think of Paul Rudd in Role Models, it's like that, but about three times more crabby. And, you know, before his alcoholic downfall, you know, he was a music critic. So like in the 90s in Seattle. So he's a huge snob and he wrote a book. He's really grouchy. And at first, you know, it's kind of a gag. And then throughout the first season, you know, as it keeps going, a lot of heart shows up. And it's still really funny. Like, it's a Farrelly. There's a ton of differently abled actors in it because that's a Farrelly thing. But really wonderful actors who you wouldn't get to see in anything else. There's a really great drama that happens with the sort of the three leads, his roommate and this other girl who he's basically been hired to try to get sober. And it develops over time. The cast of people in the meeting, the regulars of the meeting, are really funny. Brian Regan, the stand-up comedian, is one of them. Another comedian named Jackie Flynn is one of them. I burned through 2 full seasons, which is all that exists on Amazon, and I guess they're picking it up to put a third season on at some point, which I was really happy about. Ron Livingston is the best.
He's great.
He's so good, and he can do a bunch of stuff, and, you know, he can be really crabby or really sweet or, you know, whatever, and, like, he has the best eyebrows in the business. And it was a little like Lou Nixon living in a different time period after everything's fallen apart. Really funny. Like, I burned through it. I actually thought that the third season was already still on Amazon, so I was bummed out when I found that it wasn't. But great show.
There was like a period of time when this came out, they were doing like crabby protagonists on small cable networks, like Brockmeyer, with the Hank Azaria show came out at the same time.
I had that same thought about Brockmeyer, yeah.
So it's kind of like that. That was kind of the
zeitgeist. I don't know who ran that, but, you know, this script is just way more right up my alley.
Right.
It's one of those, you know, like everything about the sort of main elements was fantastic. And it's, you know, it's just a straight up single camera sitcom.
He is great.
He's so good.
Lou Nixon in Band of Brothers was also crabby. Like, he's kind of, that's his kind of thing. Even this character in Swingers was crabby.
Yeah.
He has that face.
He was hopeful. He hadn't been beaten yet. But also just like, he's a little older now. And
he'd just been Hamlet. Now he's goofy. He was a little crabby.
Check it out. I think if you like the kinds of things that I do, and I'm almost sure that you will not have heard of it. It really bugs me to think that how many like great things that are just buried in the avalanche that we're just never going to find. But I'm glad he did.
Did it have to be goofy? Those are the things we've been watching. But mostly, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I was catching up on the Oscar films. We talked about this last month. You know, we talked about the Oscars year and the nominees, because the nominees had just come out. And Ron had watched the most out of three of us.
Yep.
So between that show and this show and the Oscars, I watched all of the Best Picture nominees and a bunch of the other nominees that weren't nominated for Best Picture as well. So I really went on a tear. And watched everything. So I thought what we should do is pretend like we were Oscar voters and rank them, because that's how the Oscar voters work now. For the Best Picture, they do rank voting, which is why things often go haywire. Obviously, at the Oscars this past weekend, Nomadland won the award for Best Picture, but let's pretend like we had to have a vote. I'm very curious to see. This is not who you thought would win. We did that in our pool. But Ron, Josh, if you were a voter, how would you have voted for the Academy Award for Best Picture? That's what I want to do here for this exercise.
What is our ranking from bottom up then, right?
Right.
From 1, 2, 3.
So, like, if you had your ballot in front of you and you have
these numbers. I should recuse myself because in that time, I've watched no more of these movies.
I watched all of them.
I you just said that. I know.
I know. I'm just reiterating it. I went on because at the time, I'd only watched 2. I wanted to make a point. I tried to watch all of the Best Picture movies.
I've seen 4 of them.
Which 4 have you seen?
Twice. I saw Trial of Chicago 7, Sound of Metal, Mank, and Judas and the Black Messiah. That's what I've seen.
Okay, so out of those 4, which was your favorite? Which would you vote for?
I didn't love any of them.
Okay, I know. But which would you vote for? If you had to. You were in the Academy.
I'd go with Judas and the Black Messiah first.
Okay. And then what would be 2 and 3 and 4?
Mank, Trial of the Chicago 7, Sound of Metal.
Okay. It's a weird year. We talked about it last time, but all these movies, I think, are flawed in certain ways. They're all entertaining in certain ways. They're all great in certain ways, but... Sound of Metal, I thought, was 3/4 of a really great movie.
And you know, like, I mean, I think that the one that I've thought about the most is Judas and the Black Messiah. That's the one that has stuck with me the most. That's the one that when I, you know, I'm trying to...
It's a little... And I don't want to discuss all these films, but my take on it was, I don't think the casting worked in its favor. We talk about a lot of these films, like actors playing way older, like the Trials of Chicago 7 yep. actors and Mank, you know, Gary Oldman's 20 years older than Mankiewicz. But the two guys in Judas and the Black Messiah are 17 and 20.
Yeah, right? I read that later.
In the beginning of the film, when there's the crime that Stanfield's character pulls off that gets him in trouble with the FBI, that his hat falls off. They're like, oh, it's just a kid. And I was like, well, it's not a kid. He's fucking 35. I think it's more tragic if the FBI murders a 20-year-old than murders a 35-year-old. Now, it's tragic either way, but I felt like it would have been more sure. powerful if they cast a younger person, because it would have made it all the more awful that the FBI mm-hmm. assassinated a 20-year-old kid.
Well, they do that, though, and the movie doesn't get seen.
I know that.
It doesn't get the business of it. I mean, I know you do.
Ron, let's rank your – let's say you're a voter. You saw six or seven, or was it seven?
I saw them all except for The Father.
There's eight films.
Which after seeing the trailer and clips of The Father during the Globes, my wife and I were like, we'll opt out of that one. We talked about this on the Patron Hangout. Josh and I talked about this. The Alzheimer's movies are just – they're just hard to swallow. They're hard. Mm-hmm. They're challenging. So I did not watch that one. So that will be – I'll rank that at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably – so then seven, I would probably put Judas and the Black Messiah.
Seventh place.
Yeah. Then sixth, I'd probably put Sound of Metal.
Mm-hmm.
Fifth, I'd probably go Minari,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was beautiful and I really liked, but still it's tough.
Bummer.
Fourth, I would go Trial of the Chicago 7. Third, I go Promising Young Woman. Second, Mank. And first, Nomadland.
Okay. It's interesting to me because, again, I watched all these Best Picture nominees and I watched a ton of the other ones. And two of my three favorite films aren't even nominated for Best Picture.
And those are?
One Night in Miami and Another Round.
I didn't think One Night in Miami was very good, to be honest.
I thought it was terrific. I thought it was my
I started to watch it and got bored.
I thought it was okay. And the thing is that, like, I know it's a theater adapted into film, but, like, it was rough for me, I thought.
I loved it. My best picture of the year was Another Round. My second best picture was One Night in Miami. My third best picture, which would be number one on my ballot, would be The Father.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's really incredible. Like, I didn't want to watch it for the same reason you guys didn't want to watch it. The article about Alzheimer's and sleep that came out a week after I watched it and me being going through a period of insomnia at the same time didn't help my mental state, but it blew away every other movie. It's a complete film in a way that most of these other nominees are not complete films.
So spoiler, you know, tell me why. Like, I'm not gonna watch it, but like, what am I missing out on?
I think Anthony Hopkins blows away every other actor in the nominee. I think Chadwick Boseman was incredible in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but the range of emotion that Anthony Hopkins plays, and even in one scene, there's a scene where he plays the most charming man you've ever met to a man devolving into dementia all in one scene. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And then they play with the physical idea of dementia with the actors and the sets. Like, they keep changing. The actors keep changing.
I can't watch that.
Like,
I literally, like, even you just talking about them changing, like, nope.
Like, his apartment changes the way it looks. The actor who plays his daughter keeps changing.
This reminds me of when Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind came out, and I love that movie and was raving about it, and I was friends with someone who's bipolar, and she was like, yeah, no, I can't do it. Sorry.
Totally understandable.
Yeah, totally.
To me,
yeah,
as a cinematic piece, it was head and shoulders above everything else I watched this year.
Right.
And I was surprised. I was really surprised. It was the last one I watched. I very reluctantly watched it.
Fascinating.
So if I'm ranking these actual nominees, it's The Father, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, Judas and the Black Messiah, Minari, Mank, Sound of Metal, Trial of Chicago 7. That would be my ranking if I was ranking the...
So to pull back around, last time there had been a discussion about Nomadland
mm-hmm.
where Ron was like, no, you really got to see it, and you had preconceptions about it. So how did that end up?
I totally vindicated myself. These movies are all bummers. They're all, every single movie I watched this year was a bummer, which is why I loved Another Round so much, because it wasn't a bummer.
Uh-huh. Yep.
All the Best Picture nominees are bummers, super bummers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great. As I said at the last episode, they're all going to be well-made, beautiful films, but at the end mm-hmm. of the movie, they're all depressing.
that really has a lot to do with why I didn't spend any time watching them, because I don't want it now. Which is I think really weird. So maybe next year you'll see that sort of zeitgeisty thing, because these weren't made, you know, prior to the pandemic when
exactly.
You know, they were like, they didn't know we were going to be all depressed.
No, right. Not at all. So, but I would recommend another round. It's an uplifting film that has sadness in it for sure, but it also has a lot of joy in it, and doesn't make you feel bad about yourself and the world after it's over, like all the other films did. It was easily my favorite film of the year. So there you go. Yeah. So right. if so, Ron's favorite film of the year was Nomadland.
Yep.
Josh, your favorite film of the year was?
I don't even know what my favorite film of the year is.
Of the nominees?
Honestly, I would tell you I don't have one.
But if you had to, gun to your head, you had to pick a favorite.
Trial of Chicago 7.
Okay. My favorite of the nominees was The Father. My favorite of the year was Another Round. It was a weird year.
I couldn't even tell you what movies I've seen. Like they didn't make an impact.
Palm Springs?
No.
That's not an Oscar film, though.
It could still be
my
favorite.
Just talking my favorite about movie of the year. Yeah.
My favorite movie I saw this year was when I saw Raiders in the theater. That was my favorite movie of the year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, that's a good segue to our next segment.
Great segue. Yeah.
In which we were talking about what we were going to do, and Ron said, I want to talk about fan service.
Well, yeah. Well, so I wanted to share the fact that I, following in Josh's footsteps, I rented a theater a couple weeks ago and took my wife out to go see Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which is my favorite of the Indiana Jones trilogy.
It's my favorite as well.
We named the dog Junior.
Because there's only three films in the Indiana Jones library.
Jaws. Indiana Jones movies.
Exactly. So when I saw that AMC had made that available as part of the same program that Josh, you saw Raiders in, we jumped at it because it's also a longtime favorite movie of both me and my wife. We actually used to watch it on New Year's Eve in high school and in college. Like, instead of going out, we would stay in and we'd make cookies and we'd watch Indiana Jones The Last Crusade. Like, it was a thing. So, like,
that's adorable.
It's got some emotional resonance for us. And so it was great. It was awesome. And as I'm watching it, as we're talking about it on the way home, and we're kind of like, it's been a while since we've both seen it. She had never seen it in the theater. I saw it when it came out in 1989 in the theater at the Comac Multiplex on Long Island. I remember going
my
to see it.
My favorite part is that all of your movie memories include a complete exact description of which theater you saw them at every time.
Yeah, sure, yeah. It's part of the experience, Connor.
I saw it a few years ago at a Revival theater in LA. They were showing it. It's probably
well, what's all, what's interesting to me is that you do that is because, like, where I grew up, there was a movie theater.
Yeah,
that's where I saw all the movies. Like, there was no choice.
So it'd been a while since we had seen it together, and much less in the big screen. So we're analyzing it on the car ride home, and it dawned on me and realized, and Josh, Connor, I feel like we've talked about this before in the past, but I feel like given the Marvel movies and given so many of the kind of nerd genre movies that have come out in the last 20 years, you know, whenever there's a bit of fan service or a bit of, you know, kind of nod to the people in the audience who are in the know, that generally has been frowned upon by us, where it's like groan, it was too much fan service or blah, 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 or whatever. You know,
should we define this?
Sure. Yeah. How would you define fan service?
I mean, I think it's almost like it's a postmodern wink to a portion of the audience about something that is related to the area of interest of the thing, or might be the director's preference of a thing, you know. So
I think you were almost there and then you veered off. I think fan service is it winking to the audience who knows about either the backstory or the source material, or it's a wink to the audience.
The thing that got me was that, like, so we universally disliked the Solo movie, right? And
no, Josh loved it.
Oh, that's bizarre. That was great. Oh, I'm sorry, revisionist history. It's awful. But anyway,
I didn't say it was good. I said it was really fun.
But Josh, you have to agree that the moments of fan service in that film were groan inducing, right? Exactly. Including how Han gets his last name. Right. Like that whole thing. And then I'm sitting in there watching Indiana Jones' Last Crusade, and it's the beginning opening scene where River Phoenix plays young Indy, which became its own franchise in its own right. And he's on the circus train. He's trying to get away from the robbers, the Cross of Coronado, yada, yada. And he falls into the lion train car and he grabs the whip to kind of keep the lion at bay. And he does the first whip and it snaps back and it draws blood on his chin, which explains why Harrison Ford or Indy has a scar on his chin. Right. And I was like, why is this okay?
What do you mean?
Because it made you feel good.
Right, like, because, like, at that, because I remember when that happened in 1989, we're like, oh my god, it explained the scar, and like, it, I remember looking back on it fondly as like a good thing, and then like when they're in Venice going to find the knight's tomb, and there's cave drawings in the catacombs, and there's a drawing of the Ark of the Covenant, and she's like, what's that? He's like, the Ark of the Covenant. And she's like, how do you know? He's like, I'm pretty sure, right? And it's like, I remember thinking about that, like, oh, he's referencing the other movie, and like that, whatever, and like, well, I just see that as like a like so my the question I have for you guys that if Indiana Jones Last Crusade came out today and did those two things, would we be as overly sensitive to it as we were when Solo did it, or is it just because they did it more?
I don't know if you can count Harrison Ford's scar being the same thing as fan service.
That's fan explaining the scar as fan service. That is,
I mean,
it's the same thing as explaining Han Solo, like giving Han Solo's last name. It's the exact same thing.
I don't agree with that.
Because a couple of things. You have to qualify it with there's a fuck ton of water under the bridge from 1989 to now in terms of what you've seen, what we've seen happen in pop culture. Pop culture being self-referential and being postmodern became the thing. And at a certain point, that was a much newer thing. You know, that, you know, in 89, there was no internet. You know, there was nods and winks. And then there's the level of sort of like, you can't look at something as a 35-year-old the way you look at something as a 12-year-old. It's not going to make you feel like that.
Right.
So your tolerance will have changed for various reasons. So it's difficult to say, but I think it's a little bit of who the audience is in mind for that kind of thing. Now, what you're just describing in the Indiana Jones movie is a moment that isn't explained. It isn't talked about. He picks up a thing.
He doesn't turn to the camera and wink at it.
Exactly. And so that's exactly where I'm going at. Whereas in Han Solo, it was like, Solo. Yeah. You know, like it was.
They made a big deal of it. They drew it out.
Dumb. And it also wasn't good. Like, it was a stupid reason to have it. Like the thing where he's a kid and he's doing a thing that's like he's going to do later. And he falls and he picks up a whip because it happens to be there. And then he gets himself, you know. Isn't like, what was it like? I forget what the joke was in it, but it was a hacky joke in the Solo movie. It was a bullshit hacky joke. So that has a lot to do with it, I think. It's not just
the at the end of the day, it's like everything else. It's like how successful is the execution of it?
Right.
Like if it's a good joke or a good wink and nod, then fine. I mean, I don't necessarily hate fan service.
No.
As I get, I think, Ron, you've gotten. It sounds like you've gotten more militant against it as you've gotten older. I've gotten more blasé about it.
Well, it depends on it because
it just depends on how well it's executed. That's all.
When we were talking about the Falcon and Winter Soldier on the hangout, you were like, "Oh my god, it was Wolverine's bar." You know, like that's fan service. You like
for sure, for sure. Shit. Yeah, like yeah. Well, I mean, Easter egg fan service. I don't know where that falls.
Well, what about like in The Phantom Menace, where like in Watto's junkyard, there's the 2001 ship.
What about the camera linger on it though?
In Force Awakens, when Finn is in the Falcon looking for things and he takes out the training remote and throws it, right?
I love that. I'm totally fine with that because it was subtle.
It depends on how much you linger on it. Like that's something it's in passing. And if you know, you know. And if you don't know, it doesn't matter. The Solo thing stands out because it's a scene that you can't get past. Whereas that ship from the video game that's in one of the special edition of Star Wars films, it's in the background. If you don't know that, then it's just a ship in the background. But if you do, then it's there. And that's okay.
Yeah, in The Mandalorian, they had the ice cream maker. And you love that.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's so fucking subjective.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't like certain kinds of jokes because, you know, like, that was a dumb joke. But that's because that's not your kind of joke.
Yeah, I just find it fascinating at why one gets cleared and another one doesn't.
I mean, that's like saying how come some songs are okay.
Yeah,
the both instances you referenced from Indiana Jones, I'm fine with because the Ark of the Covenant reference, it's in passing. He's going down this tunnel. They don't stop and linger on it, and also it's closing the loop on the story. Like it starts with the Ark of the Covenant and ends with the third film, I guess, whatever. And they're closing the loop on it. You know, so I don't mind that necessarily. There's a lot of referential stuff in that film. You know, him going back to his classroom in the third film and the girls acting the same way they did in the first film is also a reference to the first film.
Sure, yeah. Can we talk about the fact that...
I want to watch Indy now.
I feel bad for his students.
Well, yeah, he's never there. The TA's teaching all the time.
Never there. I mean, they're all waiting in his office, and he climbs out the window. How long did they stay before they realized that he was gone?
He also says very specifically, X never marks the spot. And clearly, yes. Indy knows that's not true. So he lied to them.
Well, they had nothing else to do then, though.
That's true. Yeah. It was the 30s.
It was the 30s. There was nothing going on.
Just go to school or plow the fields.
Can I just say how much I love that movie? Oh, that movie is so
Raiders
good.
Is a better film, quote unquote, from like objective standpoints, but
movie, yeah.
Last Crusade is my favorite. Like, I will watch Last Crusade at any moment of any time.
Yeah.
Great Sean Connery.
Oh, it's so good. I got to say, like, the thing that struck us the most from it was how well Sean Connery and Harrison Ford nailed the parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, and also with a older parent and a middle-aged child. And it's funny because I feel like every time I watch that movie, there's a different moment that makes me laugh for different, you know, for whatever it is. And for some reason, I just laughed out loud. We're the only people in the theater, so I could. But when they're escaping from Castle Grunwald and they get through the fire and the Nazis and blah, 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 and they run outside and Indy turns on the motorboats and I can't even talk about it. And Sean Connery gives him his bag, and Indy throws the bag back at him. And then Indy goes off to get the motorcycle, and Sean Connery just goes, "But what about the boat? Like, I thought we were going on the boat." Like, I just, it's such a, like, the his dad doesn't know what he's doing, and he's trying to keep up. And it's just like that, like, gap between being in the moment and dealing with your older parent was just great. And like the time, like when they're on the motorcycle and they finish the fight, and Sean Connery just pissed off. And he's like setting his watch and like doing that pursed lip look at him. Like, they just nailed that so well. And it was so, like, they used humor in a way that balanced out the gravity of the chase for the Grail and Nazis and all this sort of stuff. It's such a great balance between action and humor. Like, so good. So, so good.
To get back to the original point, Josh, you're usually very anti that kind of thing. Anti fan service, anti winks and nods. You normally hate that stuff. Have you mellowed over the years?
No, I think it all has to do with how it's done. Like, I think how subtle something is, how interesting something is, how hacky it's done. Like, there's definitely, I think some things are, you know what, I'm having a hard time because I really can't think of examples right now, so it makes it a little harder. But I think it always has to do with how subtle something is. Like, if something's really big or just an obvious, you know, ploy, or, you know, it's just a thing where you can show the audience something and it all makes them remember something from when they were kids. They're like, yeah, as opposed to, you know, like a smaller thing that maybe not many people are going to grab onto. So if you're talking about the ice cream maker in The Mandalorian versus like a moment in a Transformers movie, you know, that's dumber. And that's because I have a pretty finely tuned sense of what I think is clever and what isn't. And it's utterly subjective, and I know that the things that make me happy in movies don't tend to happen so much in newer stuff that's made, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we all gravitated so much towards The Mandalorian when it came out, was because they got it just right. You know,
I think it's part of the problem is, I think if you look at Star Wars, let's take Star Wars as an example. So on one end of the spectrum, you have The Mandalorian. Other end of the spectrum, you have the prequels. Mm-hmm. I feel like the prequels were just an extended wink and nod. You know, we spent a lot of time lingering on things. You know, go back even further to the special editions and Boba Fett basically stopping and looking at the camera like Jim Halpert in The Office.
Yeah.
That's bad fan service, as opposed to things that happen that don't affect the story, don't slow it down, don't take you out of it. But if you recognize it, that's great. If not, that's fine too.
I mean, there's the idea of like trying to explain things that happened that don't need explanation.
Right, that's the other thing. Yeah, that's a fan.
There's all sorts of ways that could go wrong in The Last Crusade, I suppose, but it worked in that. Whereas, you know, the prequels were largely about that. And it was like, why are we sitting through this? I don't care.
It's all about explaining things.
It was all about having the moment where you could be like, oh my God, that's C-3PO. But it wasn't very satisfying because it was just from out of nowhere. It wasn't organic. It wasn't clever. It wasn't anything. It was just like, look, C-3PO is here. It's like, you know, those things where
who made him?
It was like on old TV shows where they would just have a random celebrity on, you know, and we're all supposed to know, and it wasn't cool, or, you know, it's
like Art Carney,
something like that.
Or B. Arthur,
you know, it is the way that, like, it happens a lot now. I think because so many movies will like have a celebrity cameo. you know, and people playing themselves and do, and it's just like that, having the moment where everybody recognizes something together and having it being a real big thing. It's a very different thing than a check out this really cool little thing that happened. Look at the, I keep going back to it, but look at the Will Road ice cream maker. You know, that is a thing that flashes by in the background, and 3% of people who watched Star Wars are going to get that. And it's not like, look how cool we are because we knew about this thing, because trust me, we're not cool. It is not cool to know about Will Ro Hood and the ice cream maker, but it is a little thing where, you know, like if you take Star Wars, here we go. For a long time, it was an art thing. There was a few of us left who gave a shit anymore. And I know it was the biggest movie on Earth, but at a certain point, like, nobody cared anymore.
No, it was not. In 1992, it was not cool. Like, I got made fun of.
And now, you know, everybody's got it, and it's fine. But every once in a while, like, oh, there's a little thing there for people like me. And that, you know, that's something.
People like having their things validated. You like having a reference. Like, I know that thing. People like feeling like they're on the inside, and they get the thing that no one else gets. They like it. I like it.
No, you're absolutely right. But I do think there's also just an element of it. You know, it just gives you a feeling that you had once.
Yeah.
You know, that somebody's saying, I understand you. And it's not, we all understand you, because I have a hard time with that. But like, it's just like, hey, you guys over here, check this. Okay. And we move along. It's like they're just flashing a little thing at you.
The thing, the difficult thing is that fan service can be identified in a very wide swath. Like theoretically, in Falcon and the Soldier, the very fact that they went to Madripoor could be considered fan service, you know, by some people. It's just hard.
In a way, having John Walker in there, I was like, that's fans. I mean, like, you have to, I mean, almost all of WandaVision, Jesus. I mean, like, it's some hardcore Marvel fan service, and it could fall on its face really easily, except when it doesn't.
Right. When it works, right?
It really is that.
Yeah.
And I think as your aesthetic gets more finely tuned about the things you like and the things you don't, and for me, like as sort of entertainment culture changes, you know, what it is and how it presents itself, then less of it feels meaningful to me. So when something does, it's like, oh, that's great. That makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I think it just comes back to what Josh said and what we all think, I think, is that eventually it's just fan service can't be the focus.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's done well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The most successful fan service is something that you and I recognize, but the person who doesn't know doesn't recognize, but it doesn't take away from their enjoyment of the film or the TV show or whatever. That's the most successful fan service. I don't hate fan service. I get a goofy charge off of things that I recognize from something.
Yeah, it just gotta be good, and it can't be forced. You know, like I go back to the Solo thing. I go back to, you know, like also like the Imperial March being used as the recruitment video in Solo, like that just broke my head.
There was dumb shit in there. I think the thing that I kind of liked about that movie was that I just thought it was going to be absolutely fucking terrible. And it turns out that like the actors in it were pretty good, you know, doing a thing. And then it was kind of a heist movie. And I was like, all right, you know, that could be, it's, you know, it's no prequel. It's at least something to watch. Yeah.
Josh, I haven't heard your ranking of all Star Wars movies in a while.
Well, it's somewhere on an episode of Star Wars Minute. You can go look that up. I'm sure I had to do it the last time I was there.
No, they didn't make you do it in this round, which I was shocked. I was shocked by.
Well, just go back to the definitely made me do it in the last one. So, so you should watch the Force Awakens one. It'll be in that one.
Where do you put Solo? So we all know that for you, the original trilogy is at the top.
Sure.
And then where do you put Solo? Where does it end up? Just in general.
I mean, it's not high, but it's probably.
Where do you put it in relation to the new trilogy? Just give us your ranking.
It's hard because I don't know that I've thought about it very much since then, but I haven't seen any of them more than once. So we'll go for recent. We'll say Force Awakens, Rogue One, Solo, the Sith one, and then Last Jedi. How's that?
The Sith one?
Yeah, the
Revenge of the Sith?
Revenge of the... What is it called? No, that's the third prequel.
Rise of Skywalker.
There you go. There's a lot of Palpatine in that. Sith, I don't know. That's how much I think about them, which is fine. Like, it's not, you know, it's a little like, you know, they're fun. It's not my Star Wars. I don't really give a
shit. You're much more blasé about this as you've gotten older, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Because if we did this discussion 10 years ago, you would have been like, all fan service is terrible.
Yeah, agreed.
All right.
Which is fine. I think it's great.
I think that one of the things that happened over that time is that as we are.
You realize the unimpeachable approach of death, and there's nothing you can do about it, so might as well not get upset about fan service.
I just spent a lot of time around annoying nerds, and I was like, oh, I don't want to be like that. No, I think that, like, when we were, you know, sort of getting into college, you had Kevin Smith come along.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have that postmodern period, that Kevin Williamson, and, you know, doing a thing that was kind of clever for people was like new. And then it got to the point where, like, making the reference itself was the same as being clever. And that
was the second wave. The first wave was.
Yes.
Kevin Williamson made a great film and wrote a great film and Scream.
Yeah.
That was self-referential and postmodern, referencing other old films, but it was a great film in and of itself. The second wave was just about referencing.
Yes.
Yeah. They lost the first part. They like The Cure for Cancer. They lost the idea that you still got to make a great film.
I had The Cure for Cancer and I lost it.
Don't do that anymore.
Aside, if you're listening to this, you know. My wife asked me, she said, what's your favorite patron power that you've ever given away? And I was like, I think it's, if you have lost the cure for cancer, he'll find it.
But you have to lose it first. You have to lose it.
If you're like, hey, I had the cure for cancer. And he's like, I got that. I can find it. He's the guy who can find it.
Wait, can he find it if other people lose it?
Anybody
no, he
who loses
has to find it.
He has to find it, but anyone can lose it. Like, I could lose it. Yeah, like, I found it, I lose it. I see.
Right.
I mean, that would be so specific if he had to also lose it. That'd be just really difficult to take advantage of. Anyway. Yeah, no, I think that's it. And we get to this point where now, I see this in real life, people equate, like, saying a joke from something with being funny. And it's not the same thing.
Well, I don't want to be old man River, but I'll do it.
Yeah.
I think that what you're seeing now is, like, an app like TikTok exists entirely to repurpose old material. Like, it seems like... It's all remixing. It's all lip syncing. You know, it's all like, I'm going to put a spin on this old thing. It's not creating a new thing. And so I think the culture is headed into like this Ouroboros of eating its own cultural tail.
That is the finest bit of vocabulary you have used in, I don't know how
long. And I've had like five Mai Tais. The thing is like, this is me at a bar, by the way, if everyone wants to know what I'm like at a bar. The studio system in Hollywood isn't combating that. It's just reusing old IP because that's the thing they can bank on. So we're in this cultural moment where between every show from the 80s and 90s coming back and everyone on TikTok just repurposing old material, that we're almost in this world where there's no – it's all fan service now.
Yeah. It's the thing is, most of it is going to be garbage. But then occasionally, like, oh, that Cobra Kai show is surprisingly good.
Right.
You know,
and
when it works, it works. It has to do with approach and technique and aesthetic and everything. But so much of it is just like, look, guys, it's Optimus Prime.
Right.
Huh?
Which actually has to do something. Like, you have to actually make it good. It can't just be, it's not enough to just say, hey, look at this. Look at that guy over there. You remember that guy from when you were a kid?
Community was a show, I think, that really tread that line. You know, like, they referenced a lot of stuff. And whereas like the reason that I don't like Jimmy Fallon is because his show is like, remember this thing you used to like?
Right.
Remember it? And then, you know, that's it. Whereas like Community was doing that, but in a really clever and interesting way. And you didn't feel like you were being pandered to as much as there was a take on something that was interesting that you hadn't thought about in a long time. I don't know. It's very nitpicky. Like what works in one thing doesn't work for another. And who knows?
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
Good call out, Ron, from your film.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely got me thinking and what works and what doesn't work and all that stuff. But just whatever you do, go revisit Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade because it's a good time.
So good. And Raiders. And you know what? You probably have a damn good time at Temple of Doom.
I enjoy Temple of Doom. It was on the other day. It's still super fun.
Temple of Doom, I have lots of issues with.
When I was a kid, the bugs freaked me out, and I never really gave it a fair chance.
Yeah, no, the it was very violent for a young...
It's dark. It's the first PG-13 film.
It's dark. Kate Capshaw, I have issues with. Club Obi-Wan. There's fan service.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd end the show with an email, which is going to be right in our wheelhouse. It's from Stephen B., and he writes and says... Oh, he's from Maryland. Stephen B. from Maryland says, can I get your hot take on HBO's Vinyl?
Huh. Ooh.
Which was a show that ran on HBO that we all loved. It ran for one season. It was executive produced by Martin Scorsese, and did he direct the first episode?
Yeah, he did. Yep.
He directed the first episode. It was Scorsese, and I think it was also Mick Jagger. Like, it was a high pedigree in the music business.
It was created by Mick Jagger, Martin Scorsese, Rich Cohen, and Terrence Winter.
And he ran in 2016. It was after Boardwalk Empire. We were very excited for it. It came out to much fanfare.
Great Ray Romano.
Lasted only for one season. It got renewed, and then it got unrenewed. Yep. It was a rare thing where after the first episode, they renewed it, HBO renewed it, and then eventually they said, nah, you know what? Never mind. We changed our mind. Yep. It starred Bobby Cannavale and Olivia Wilde and Ray Romano and Juno Temple. It had a really great cast set in the 1970s in the New York City music scene. Yep. And we fucking loved that show, the three of us.
Yeah, loved it.
All three of us.
I don't know that I loved it that much more at the end of the season.
That's the thing. So I think the hot take is
Bobby Cannavale.
Great concept, great potential, and then it steadily declined through the season and crashed.
I think it lost its way a little bit.
Yep.
There's a bit where, Christ, I can't remember his name, the musician who Bobby Cannavale had the falling out with, and he does the thing where he explains, and I'll never forget it, is he does the thing where he explains the 1-4-5 chord in rock music, and he goes through all this different stuff, and it just breaks down all pop music of the last century, and I was like, that's one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, you know, there's the introduction of hip hop in the Bronx sort of shows up there, sort of music history stuff and a place and time. Who's the kid supposed to be? The punk rock kid.
Other than Mick Jagger's kid?
Yeah. Like, isn't he supposed to, like,
it's influenced by that moment of, you know, New York Dolls, pre-CBGB, you know, like, there's a moment in music history in, like, 74, 75. I mean, this takes place, when was this supposed to take place? It took place in
1973.
73, yeah. So it's in those years before it, AOR, you know, what we consider classic rock is at its height, you know, like Zeppelin and all that.
The New York Dolls were on the show.
Were early 70s, Connor. Like,
There were a lot of those characters on the show.
The floor falling in, which is the thing that fucking happened.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Which is what it feels like at Webster Hall at a Bad Religion show.
The thing is, the three of us, we have our Slack channel now. And at the time, I guess, where did we talk? Was it on Skype? We had whatever channel we discussed. So there's always a show. In 2016, it was Vinyl, where every Monday morning, we would just obsessively discuss it in whatever channel we were doing while we were working. You know, previously it was like Boardwalk Empire before Vinyl, but there's always a show, and we all loved Vinyl.
Yeah.
For all of its faults, we loved it.
And also, it was the one that had the potential, like, boy, I hope this keeps being good. Yeah. You know, it's like, this is all the ingredients.
Jack Quaid, who's now on The Boys, was the young AR guy.
And it had that cool thing where you see a little bit of the mafia involvement in the music industry at the time, and, you know.
Bo Dietl was the independent promotion man with possible ties to the organized crime industry.
Yeah.
But you had also a ton of music, like, you know, like I said, New York Dolls were characters, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin. Like, it was really living in that early 70s world. Oh, that's terrific.
I don't think about it a lot. It's not like it's
it was 10 episodes 7 years, 6 years ago. I mean, it was.
The guy who played Lester Grimes, that actor has been in a bunch of stuff since then, I think, or something else where I was like, oh, it's him. Oh, he was in that Mars show that got canceled. That's where I knew him.
But there was all kinds of things that they just didn't get to explore. I thought Ray Romano's character was interesting. He clearly closeted. That episode where he falls in love with the singer who was singing the Bowie song at the piano bar. It also featured Bowie. Like, that's a great episode. I still think about that sometimes.
Yep.
It had a lot of potential. It just, for whatever reason, it was really expensive. Period pieces are expensive. Music rights are expensive. It clearly just didn't.
Jagger's a pain in the ass to work with.
It didn't do what they thought it was going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's perhaps too neat.
Plus, Terrence Winter left the show in the middle.
Yeah, it just seems like it started with such energy and such a great kind of moment and just kind of declined and became formulaic by the end of it. Like, that's what this
like Altamont.
Yeah.
Well, there was no murder at the end of this one.
Yeah. Wasn't there?
But if you ask us, I think if you asked us, like, look at all the shows that like got canceled that you're sad about over the years, and we really got to sit down and think about it, I think Vinyl would be on all of our lists.
Sure, yeah.
Because we all really loved it.
Yeah.
Thanks for writing in.
That was a good one.
It's funny about those shows like that you're sad they canceled, and so I have an answer. I'd be like, oh, yeah, Terriers. I'd love to see, not counting the movie, but I was like, Deadwood, they could. But, like, I don't remember a damn thing about Terriers other than I really liked it.
Right. Because it's so long ago, it's been 1,000 shows since then.
Yes.
Yeah.
But contact@ifanboy.com is where you can write in if you want to ask us questions about an old show or whatever. We'll certainly ramble about it.
Anytime. Yeah. Happy to.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you catch us at the right time. Doesn't even have to be on the show.
Thanks, Steven. So. Yeah, we all liked it.
Yeah. I enjoyed watching it for sure. 100%. Oh, my God. I would watch it again.
You're talking about a show made for us. It was after Bobby Cannavale's star turn on Boardwalk Empire, where he won the Emmy. Getting his own show. We loved him. Set in New York in the 70s about the music industry. It was like genetically engineer a show for the three of us. That was the show.
Venn diagram. Yeah, for sure.
So there you go. That's another month of Beauty Split. Thanks for the patrons at patreon.com/fanboy. If you want to support the show, that's the best place to do it. We appreciate everything it does. It unlocks great content like this show. And so we thank you all for joining up and keeping the show going. We appreciate it. Anything else, guys? Any other thoughts? Final thoughts?
That's it.
All right. Well, you can listen to our Pick of the Week show. It's our weekly Pick of the Week show where Josh and I talk about the week's comics. We have our Book Explodes, our Media Explodes, our special edition shows. Ron has his All About Android show.
Yep, over on Twitter.
Still going.
10 years, decade long, and it's not even the longest show I've been involved with, which is you guys.
Whatever. I was about to say, are you still involved with the show? And then I realized we were literally recording a show.
Doing a show, yeah.
All right, so we'll be back in a month for the next Media Explode. Well, who knows what we'll be talking about? We don't know. Sometimes until right before the show. But until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.
I'm Josh. Thanks, everyone. It's the freakiest show.